storm is rising against the privileged minority of the earth.
This is why I say it's liberty or it's death. It's freedom for everybody or freedom for nobody.
This is an NBC News Hotline special report.
We're at a turning point in the history of this nation. We need to stand for freedom. There's an escalating authoritarianism and even a creeping fascism. Freedom is precious. If we don't fight for it, you lose it.
This much is clear.
We must rebel.
This is our country. We have always lived in it. We were happy. Then you came. We have to protect ourselves. We have to save our country. We have to fight for what is ours.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is your brother, Ryan Radice. Welcome to this Class War Battlefield podcast segment. Every so often, a country is called into action altogether to face some major challenge that exposes both the weaknesses of or within that country and also the fragments that need to be healed. COVID-19 is doing that. Now, the United States has been in a slow-moving emergency since the 60s. And at every key opportunity that this country had to make a decision at, when they could have made the right decision, the, quote, majority has always made the wrong decision. It says something that two of the three largest political landslides in this country's history came within 10 years of each other. Or, yeah, I think it was 10 years. 12 years. Nixon, I think 72 was his major landslide year. And then Reagan in 84 was his landslide year. In both instances, there was this sense that those men understood America far better than their opponents. And I'd like to say that's probably more apt than not. It is not popular among progressives, mainly, I think, because they fit into the majority in this country, to speak about the role that race and caste and the mortal wound, which really could spell the end to this country, that existed from the time that this country was just colonies. It's not looked upon fondly to talk about these things, because the left, progressives, want to believe that none of this matters as much as black people think that it matters. They want to believe that this is all about economics. This is all about economics. Well, here's the thing. While I accept the fact, I mean, for God's sakes, this is called Class War Battlefield Podcast. Well, I accept the fact that economics have a lot to do with it. I do not believe, as most progressives believe, that this is a new phenomenon. And that you could only trace the connection between economics and the rightward shift politically of the country to the last 40 years. No, this is where the deficit, the historical deficit within progressives is very evident. I've said many times before that progressives need to invest time in researching old history. I've said that many times. They haven't. You saw the same protective measures within what really was a minority of the population, but they scared the rest of the population into either inactivity or ignorance. But you saw this keeping with the industrialists, if you would, back during and before the Progressive Era. You saw it. A great book that I've listened to recently, actually it was the end of the summer, beginning of the autumn. The book is one that, how this isn't recommended reading today is beyond me. It's kind of like Uncle Tom's Cabin. That should still be recommended reading. But the book is called 100%. It's literally called 100%. The Story of an American Patriot. To understand policing, to understand the class consciousness, lack thereof, actually, and how it's been perpetuated, and this notion of right-wing rhetoric, which everyone keeps, well, 30 years ago, people kept calling it the new right-wing, the new right-wing. This isn't new. This has been in the American political body, or body politic, for ever. And I'd probably imagine if there were accurate depictions by themselves, by the way, of life in the colonies, you'd see a lot of this rhetoric there too, with slight alterations. This is something that is not new. The economics do not explain why, if you go back 120 years, you're still finding this rhetoric, and you're still finding white men, white women, who eat this rhetoric and act upon it and create this myth and live this myth as to who America is and who the wealthy are, and why people are poor, and all of that. Now, personally, I trace it back to the idea that people came to the United States, or the colonies at the time, to find a better living. That they had lived under feudalism, and they then came to the United States to find their gold, to escape feudalism, to become the lord to become the controller of land. And if you look at what the crown and the merchants who controlled the colonies were willing to do to ensure that the colonists remained loyal, because at first they did try to just hold the system how it was in England, and what happened was people would defect to the Native Americans, or they would fight, because they recognized, hey, we outnumber you, and we know how to use the weapons, so, hey, keep acting shady. Well, they became, the managers became smarter. And they started saying, well, look, we'll give you land, we'll give you some freedoms, just stay on our side so we can make money. And these Europeans did that because they didn't want to be with the savages. That was the Native Americans, by the way. When they brought over Africans, they didn't want to, you know, mingle too much with those savages, even though they did mingle with us. But that structure, that slight alteration, you see that carry on from the colonies into the United States, and then you see it carry on through the 1800s into the 1900s. This is deep, ladies and gentlemen. That's what I'm trying to tell you. It's deep. Now, we had an opportunity, starting in the 1940s, to put that put that spirit to rest. To put that past behind the country. And to chart something really new. And to rewrite history in order to save humanity. But those forces which had always been there bided their time. And in the 60s, started building up again. Their capacity to influence the general population. And they succeeded. We are, when it comes to the conservative rhetoric that's being floated, we are experiencing rhetoric that literally can be traced to the World War I era. Literally. Get the book 100%, Story of American Patriot. Seriously, read it. You'll see it in there. The sad part about it is, instead of being just the United States from that period of time, it looks like we might also be Weimar, the Weimar Republic, Germany. Because we are tumbling into a depression. The interesting thing is, after reading Matt Stoller's Goliath and his revelation that the United States almost fell into a depression in, I think it was 1921, I couldn't even tell you. The country wasn't even prepared to deal with a major depression in 1921. So we were lucky that it held itself off for 8 years. This country isn't ready for a depression, even though there's many places and pockets, large pockets in this country, that arguably have been in a depression for years, some of them for decades. But I digress. Because every so often, a country is forced to make decisions. We are faced, every so often a country is faced with a crisis that forces them to make a decision about their future. And this decision has far-ranging consequences. FDR, thankfully, made some decisions that had far-reaching consequences. We are coming to the close of a period of time that literally was started by FDR. That's how far-reaching that decision, that's how far-reaching it was. The modern conservative rhetoric that I just previously said really could be traced all the way back to the late 1800s, early 1900s. That was brought back. That was resurrected to help with a program that was really initiated back in the 1970s and much farther before that, but it was, I think, more discernible in the 1970s. But to help with that program, which was meant to roll back the New Deal. Now, we have to understand that we are on the cusp of major changes being, I think, imposed on this country. The irony is, with the introduction of COVID-19, the crises which were already evident to most people who aren't living in the suburbs, most people who aren't living in the wealthy areas in the country. Those crises were going to come to a head sometime in the next 6 to 7, maybe 6 to 8 years. But because COVID-19 struck or was introduced, those crises have come to the surface much more rapidly than anyone could have thought. What this means is that the United States of America, citizenry now, is going to have to make some tough decisions. And some of those tough decisions are already starting to be made. Will this country be a country which feeds a republicanism which throughout history has really resulted in the coming into existence of authoritarian rulership? Or will the citizenry feed a democracism which throughout history has led to greater learning, greater advancement for humanity as a society, and will help lead the world to new heights in moral and just treatment? Which one is chosen is not yet clear. But there has to be a choice. I have said to others when talking to them about the problems inside this country and this world, I have said to them that the issues with this country didn't just start with slavery or the genocide of the Native Americans. Those evils were already in place when this country was actually founded. No. This country's problem started when it chose republicanism over democracy. This odd adherence to a mythology that this country is a democracy is laughable. We are not. This country has never been a democracy. This country has always been a republic. Well, you can have a democratic republic. No, you can't. No. And the founding fathers were relatively clear about this. This is a republic. They didn't want a democracy. Because, see, in a democracy, you had to have economic rights. And the citizens, note, when you look at the Constitution, it doesn't speak that heavily towards citizen economic rights. Why? Well, because, one, only a handful of people were considered citizens, and we don't talk about that, but they were. And most of those people had property and thus had rights. There wasn't any question that if they had rights or not. But the people who weren't like them, who didn't own land, you know, their rights could be given by their states. But most of the states, they didn't, the rights depended on the plantation you were on or the spot of land that you were on, any of that. Most of the states even were like, we'll let the economy deal with it. We'll let the people who own the businesses deal with it. And since, you know, the states were run by men who often had property, who had business concerns, they weren't interested. And we need to be very clear about this. The majority of them were not interested in giving their serfs that much power. So they weren't for democracy. They were for republicanism. Another reason they were for republicanism was because in the ancient world, republicanism not only enabled slavery and allowed it, but slavery, especially with the Romans, slavery was an integral part to republicanism. Not only was slavery an integral part, but the hyper-exploitation of those that were one step above slavery, or sometimes two steps above slavery, but not quite citizens. Was a key and instrumental part to republicanism's success. This comes right out of Rome, ladies and gentlemen. The United States picked a system. Picked a system which would enable hyper-exploitation, enslavement, and would allow it to be able to expand without worrying too much about what the ordinary citizen said. Now, as long as the ordinary citizen, which these people were mostly serfs, were the beneficiaries of that and didn't have to worry too much about what they did with the land once they got it, most serfs didn't care what the government was doing, as long as they got to benefit from it. But then, when the keys started turning towards the Industrial Revolution, particularly after the Civil War. And the resulting transformation from a hyper or a mostly agrarian society moved to a mostly industrial society, republicanism was transformed. It was transformed into a grotesque governing format that allowed for people to rule certain areas in the country like kingdoms. What did they used to call them? They used to call these people tycoons, and there's another word that it's a royalty one, and I can't believe I'm completely, you know, muffing it right now, because it really shows you how these people used to view this country as just a bunch of little fiefdoms put together back in the 1890s. But anyway, just like with the Roman Empire, and excuse me, the Roman Republic, which saw its richest men become obsessed with becoming richer and building ever greater empires. Back then it was clients, client lists. The same thing happened in the United States. The same thing happened in the United States. And again, to show you that these people were not concerned about democracy, they wanted people to be able to vote. That's fine. Republicans always want people to be able to vote. Republics always want people to be able to vote. But, when it came to economic voting, when it came to economic participation, these people were serfs. They were serfs. And the labor movement, even though I don't even know if they understood this is what they were fighting for half the time, is they were really fighting to make the society more democratic. They were pushing to have the society be more responsive to the needs of the average person. It was FDR who finally said, republicanism has gotten out of control. We need to temper it with something. We need to add a little bit more democracy to this place because it's getting way too off kilter and off balance. And either I'm going to add some democracy to it or you're going to have a communist revolution. Interesting fact, ladies and gentlemen. The idea of communism, which is, you know, forbidden to study, but the idea of communism is not new, just like the idea of socialism, not new. I know a lot of people like to think it's new, but neither of them are. It is arguable that many of the indigenous people in what we call South America, Central America, North America, and some places in Africa, actually lived in communes. They lived in communes, and some of them even lived in what we would call federated commune societies. So each commune would have its own structure and, you know, culture and what have you, and then there'd be another commune and another commune, and then they'd come together and they'd make decisions about whatever they needed to make decisions about. Another interesting fact about communism is the reason why communism turned into a totalitarian dictatorship when it came to the Russians and the Soviets is because they tried to fit an ideology which demanded hyper-democratization on a structure which did not. Interesting fact. But I digress. So FDR made that decision. And even though he had to fight every step of the way to get it passed, by him adding that drop, couple of drops, of democracy, yes, it helped economically. But from a greater perspective, and I remember Chris Hedges talking about this, it relieved some of the huge pressure put upon Republicanism. Now, ladies and gentlemen, we have to understand, Republicanism, the major issue with Roman-style Republicanism, and the United States just copied what Rome did, tweaked it a little bit, and said, hey, it's new. The major issue with Roman Republicanism was it didn't have enough safety valves. If you had a couple of generations of people who were self-absorbed, what Roman Republicanism revealed, was that they became detached from the Commonwealth concept that all of the higher statesmen had preached. They became detached from the real plight of the populace. And they became almost drugged down by this obsession to be greater and greater and greater and greater than those who came before them. Well, again, if you have a couple generations where this happens, guess what the result is? The result is that the upper class becomes so utterly detached from the lower class that they begin to literally look down on them and see them as undeserving of their attention. These people become mortal gods, basically, you know, spitting on immortal gods to themselves, spitting on the mortals below. Well, it is absolutely possible to see a connection between that type of republicanism and this type of republicanism. The politicians are supposed to be there at the very lowest level to tweak the system, and to release the pressure, which builds up at the bottom of the society. That's what they're supposed to be there for. In a Republican system, as long as you have attentive politicians, that works. The moment you do not have attentive politicians, that doesn't work. Now, the difference between a Republican system with representatives and a Democratic system with representatives is there are more options available to the general populace in a democracy on how to hold that representative accountable and how to get rid of them, get them out of office, if they're not doing what they need to do. But in a Republican-style government, see this with Rome, it's difficult to remove somebody who's not working and doing what needs to be done for your group. Now, in Rome, obviously, they had the Senate, and the Senate was drastically different than ours. In the United States, there is the Senate. But again, and it's so crazy because I've been thinking about this so much this year. In Rome, the Senate, what essentially caused a lot of the gridlock was because the Senate didn't want to do its job to act on behalf of the population. Sound familiar? We're kind of going through that now. Which is why I brought up the fact that every now and then, a country has to make a decision. And we are going to have to make a decision. Unlike a lot of other people, you know, I'm not ready to say that people just voted for Donald Trump this time because they believed in Donald Trump. I believe some people voted against Joe Biden. But as I think I saw it on Our Cartoon President said, the fact that these are the two candidates that this system provided says something about the system. The system is clearly not built in the favor of everyday workers. What then must be done? Well, I'm not here to offer those answers. I think some people have those answers. I do not. But what I do know is we have to make the decision on what kind of society we're going to be. We have to make the decision on whether or not we are going to be commonwealth-oriented or corporation-oriented. We are going to have to make the decision on whether or not we want to support small businesses. I was talking with a man the other day, and I happened to mention that in some European countries, you are entitled, I mean, even at the low end, you're like entitled to 3 to 3.5 weeks immediately when you start a job of paid vacation. Say nothing about sick leave. And in some of the most generous countries, you start a job, you know, you're getting 6 to 8 weeks worth of free time that your company has to pay for. And it's about time that we take that route in this country and force companies to do this. And so the friend, who's a conservative, said, oh, well, great, then you're just going to bankrupt small businesses. Small businesses can't do that. Like, it's funny because small businesses in these other countries do that, but for some reason, no, you know, small businesses here are so fragile they can't do it. Well, fine. How about we do this? Great answer to that question, which took me all but 3 seconds to figure out, ladies and gentlemen. Well, if a small business isn't making enough to be able to do that, here's what we do. Let's have the government subsidize it so small businesses can do that. Oh, another big government program, blah, blah, blah. And I go, no. Not another big government program. We already subsidize big corporations. We do. The government gives tens of billions, probably even hundreds of billions, of dollars to big corporations. You have a lot of small communities which have paid companies like Walmart to stay in their community and essentially kill it. So, no. Not another big government program. We're just shifting the priority of monies in the government. So people can have time with their families. So they can have time to themselves, so they can actually grow and participate in communities, activities, and stuff like that. And thankfully, to my utter amazement, the person accepted that as possible before then saying, well, you know, how about we just not support any business? And, well, you know, You can live in that fantasy world, but the government's going to support some business. It's always happened. This country has always had that. So, you know, you say small business is the lifeblood of the country. Let's make sure that we are supporting it at a governmental level. These are the conversations that we're going to have. We are going to have to redefine both republicanism and democracism, because what you're seeing, ladies and gentlemen, when it comes to the Democratic Party, when it comes to the Republican Party, you're seeing both parties come out, basically, as status quo instruments. They've reverted back to where they were 120 years ago, and some might even say 100 years ago. They've both reverted back to being parties of corporate dominance. They've both reverted back to being pseudo-racists. They've both reverted back to caring about the economy to the point of hurting the citizenry. And yet they both use rhetoric of, we are for the little guy. We are for the little guy. We have some decisions to make, ladies and gentlemen. And I got to tell you, I'm not optimistic. There was a time when I was, but I'm not. And it's not because I don't believe in America. No, it's because, again, I've traced this throughout the history of this country. I'm not saying don't do. I'm just saying, you know, don't fly into doing this work with your eyes covered. This country, is due for a major crisis, which will shatter its innocence, I suppose. Maybe I'm in the beginning chapters of Rick Perlstein's book, The Invisible Bridge. Maybe he's right. Maybe the innocence was shattered in the 70s, and there's been an attempt to get the innocence back. But it's due for something major to happen that'll wake it up. And just on that point, the whole idea of trying to recapture innocence, it is funny. It is funny how over the past 20 years, a little bit over, in fact, the most interesting development culturally has been the adult aimed cartoon. Look, I'm not acting like I don't watch some of those adult aimed cartoons, because I do. But this nostalgia effect, which Rick Perlstein talks about in his book, is absolutely, absolutely present. And the sound of the crowd in my ear. You might ask what I am going to end this one here. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, you know you can always reach out to me. I am your brother Vladimir Deese. See you on the next one, y'all. Peace. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again: how the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who finally can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun or a prison.